Case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in 02682 Verizon Communications versus the Law Offices of Curtis V. Trinco, LLP.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. On the facts alleged, Trinco cannot sustain its complaint unless the court newly recognizes a Section 2 duty of a monopolist to turn over its sales to rivals by sharing its assets at specially discounted prices. That is, a duty to dismantle itself. Our argument is that that hasn't ever been a Section 2 duty and shouldn't now be made into one.
We have an Illinois brick problem before we even get to this substantive question, don't we? I mean, why should we entertain this case at all?
I don't think that Illinois brick, in fact, I think Illinois brick is not a jurisdictional point. It is a question of cause of action that goes to certain kinds of damage.
Well, I understand, but those standing rules that are not jurisdictional are still standing rules, and we normally apply them. Why should we not apply our normal rule of standing in this case?
Well, we do think you should, but that it shouldn't preclude the court from reaching the merits, which are of much broader importance. That is, in the absence of the rule being a jurisdictional one, the court has the option of considering either of two grounds for reversing and reinstating the dismissal, just as the court did in the sovereign immunity case involving Israel last year, where there were two alternative grounds.
Well,
the merits question is a much more...
It seems to me you're just trying to rush to the merits. I think the standing issue is a very serious issue here.
Oh, we think so as well, and let me address that briefly.
What you're saying, basically, it's a claim for relief issue rather than a jurisdictional issue. Right?
Yes, yes. The statutory standing question has always been treated as a question of what the meaning of Section 4 of the Clayton Act, the damages provision, is here. And both the indirect purchaser rule and the more general indirectness aspect of associated general contractor has to do with who can get what kinds of relief. That's not a jurisdictional question, and therefore it remains open to this court to do what we think the court should do, which is also to address the question that is directly dividing the circuits: what is the scope of Section 2?
Toronto, you made an interesting classification, and I think I tend to agree with it, but I'm not sure that these court cases fit that mold. I had thought that the things that are put under the head of, quote, prudential standing sound like, does this person have a claim under this statute for relief? That's a 12B6 question. But the court seems to think that there's something in between constitutional standing, which everyone agrees exists here, and 12B6. And that's this prudential standing notion. Is there a difference between the 12B6 inquiry, does this statute afford this plaintiff a claim for relief, and what this court has called prudential standing?
The best that I can do with that is to describe what the court has done in the cases that we rely on for saying there's no statutory standing. Associated General Contractors and Illinois Brick and its follow-on, Kansas against Utilicorp, are all about the interpretation of Section 4 of the Clayton Act. In that sense, they are classic 12B6 questions. The entire analysis in Associated General Contractors is about what the term injury to business or property means. They are interpretive questions in that way. They're not separate prudential standing questions somewhere between constitutional standing and statutory coverage. And that's why we think it is both proper and really quite important for purposes of the several other circuit cases that are now sitting in cert petitions in this court on the merits question that divides the circuits. There is no Section 2 duty on the merits now to turn over your sales to a rival. This court said as far back as 1920 in the U.S. Steel case, Section 2 does not condemn mere size. Section 2 does not compel competition. The 1996 Act does. It has a quite different policy. It says we will mandate creation of competition. Section 2 says we protect against affirmative interferences in independently arising competition. They're fundamentally different statutory approaches to a highly general goal.
Is this a kind of refusal to deal case, so it could be covered in theory by Section 2?
It is a kind of refusal to deal. It is all of the claims in this case, all of the facts, allege inadequate help to rivals to come and displace one's own sales. This court has broadly recognized that Section 2 protects the right to just make your sales and not turn them over to rivals with a category of exceptions. Every one of those exceptions, the refusal to deal cases, involves discrimination. The firm was voluntarily in the business of selling the product that the plaintiff wanted, and the plaintiff wanted it at the same terms that the firm was selling it to others, and the defendant said no. That threshold condition has so far been the only sufficiently reliable one to trigger the inquiry. If you're selling it to everybody else, why not to the particular plaintiff? And the answer, we're not selling to the plaintiff because the plaintiff is a rival or the plaintiff is dealing with a rival, has been the one exception to the general rule that forced sales to help rivals is not adequate. Discrimination doesn't mean that mean illegality. There may be good reasons, but it so far has been the necessary threshold condition for demanding an inquiry. This case does not involve any kind of discrimination like that. There's no allegation here. There couldn't be an allegation that Verizon was in the business of renting out its facilities to rivals at specially discounted prices before the 1996 Act compelled that. So for Trinco to prevail here, the court would have to recognize something brand new under Section 2. It would have to expand Section 2 to where it has never been before. And we submit there are extremely good reasons for not doing that.
The reason Otter Tail seems like the strongest precedent against you. Before you say the reasons against expansion, I'd just like to hear 30 seconds on why, in your opinion, Otter Tail is different than this.
Otter Tail was also a case of discrimination. If the opinion in Otter Tail is a little bit shy on full explanation for what factors mattered, and so one has to look at what the facts were. If you look at the extensive findings of fact by the district judge, which are in the appendix of this case, but the appendix in Otter Tail, there's an entire section called discrimination. Otter Tail at JA 103 to 111. Otter Tail was undisputedly in the business of wholesaling power and of wheeling power to others. When particular communities came and said, we want from you the same thing that you're happily selling to others, Otter Tail said no. That's exactly the same kind of discrimination that existed in Aspen Skiing, where the Three Mountain defendants said, we won't even take full price ski tickets from people who are using the Fourth Mountain because that's a rival. So discrimination was the predicate there too. This is not a case of discrimination. In the absence of discrimination, any court entertaining a Section 2 duty would have to undertake tasks that antitrust has never viewed as appropriate. It would have to ask, what are the effects on long-run investments, the long-term effects on investments?
Now you're back into the merits, aren't you?
Yes.
Know. Did you finish with the inquiry on whether we should recognize this plaintiff?
Well, we think not, really, for a combination of reasons. All of the factors in Associated General Contractors, I think, point in the same direction. The injury here is indirect. That is, Trinco was a customer of AT&T, which was a customer of Verizon, and Trinco's injury was only an indirect result of the alleged injury to AT&T. The additional considerations point in the same direction. There's obviously a better plaintiff, AT&T. Well, the final reason I'll mention here is that recognizing the statutory cause of action here would also interfere with the voluntarily agreed upon non-judicial dispute resolution mechanism that AT&T and Verizon entered into.
Mr. Toronto, Judge Katzmann in the Second Circuit, whose decision we're reviewing, seemed to think that AT&T was not, as you expressed it, the better complainant, but that the remedy for AT&T was the administrative context. I thought his opinion suggested that for AT&T, the remedy was the administrative route. But for the customer who has no place else to go, it was court or nothing, because the customer would not have access to that administrative process. Now, is there, first of all, would AT&T have standing or state a claim for relief if AT&T had been the plaintiff here? And second, if you're right that this plaintiff has no claim in court, is there any place that this plaintiff can go? With the complaint, the reality is, and we accept what the complaint alleges is true for current purposes, I have gotten the worst service. It's a constant embarrassment. I've lost clients. I've lost my professional reputation. That's a legitimate complaint. Is there anyone in the world that that can be asserted against?
Let me take those in order, if I may. AT&T could, of course, have brought a Sherman Act suit had it not expressly waived its right to go to court. It adopted instead a mechanism by which it secured relief far more promptly than any antitrust case would have obtained. So,
but it had
like,
no choice in that. I mean, that's a statutory mechanism. There's no independent waiver that AT&T, as apart from others, what they call them, CLECs, it's a regime imposed on all the participants.
Well, that non-judicial dispute resolution was here part of an agreement. It's not in the statute. Many agreements contain it. Some agreements do not contain it. This one does, and it serves very important statutory functions of providing what here took only 3 months or so fully to resolve the problem and to provide compensation to AT&T. And that's
and at least if there hadn't been an agreement, AT&T would go where? To the commission?
It could go to the commission, or it could bring a Sherman Act suit, unless, of course, as we do contend, there is no legitimate Section 2 claim. But as far as standing is concerned, the customer, that is AT&T, has standing.
Could you clarify one thing for me? Did the AT&T settlement just settle the New York area problems, or was it nationwide?
The New York Public Service Commission settlement settled the New York problem. There was an FCC, national-level consent decree, that on a going-forward basis settled, solved the problem. The problem was, in fact, a New York-specific one, and here we're talking about the only concrete instance.
Well, I was under the impression AT&T retained the right to sue in other parts of the country. In fact, they filed an amicus brief in this case, which suggests that they still have an interest in the ongoing controversy, but not in New York.
Well, I don't know that AT&T has signed similar agreements the rest of the country. This particular problem that gave rise to this problem was fully resolved in New York with compensation to AT&T and nationally at the FCC level. So AT&T certainly, wherever it hasn't adopted an arbitration agreement the way any other plaintiff can adopt, certainly has a right to go to court and to argue, as you know, as COVAD has in the 11th Circuit case, as Cavalier has in the 4th Circuit case, to argue that there is a Sherman Act claim, and that's the merits claim that is before this court as part of this case.
As their position is that this isn't the best test case because this plaintiff didn't make all the right allegations, as I read their brief.
Well, I don't think there could have been any different allegations on the dispositive point. As long as the allegations are the incumbent insufficiently helped
the
rival.
They allege that in other areas there's been sham litigation, fraudulent misrepresentations, and affirmative misconduct in addition to failing to comply with all the requirements of the 96 statute.
And those claims, to the extent that they're not helping hand kinds of claims, would, of course, be outside the analysis. The Cavalier case, the COVAD case, are overwhelmingly, as this case is, helping hand cases, as the Goldwasser case in the Seventh Circuit was. And that's the core issue that that all of these cases are about.
Would now, you get to the last part? Does this customer of AT&T have any remedy for the bad service that the customer attributes not to AT&T but to Verizon?
Yes. Well, first, in this very case, the Second Circuit reinstated the Section 202 claim of this plaintiff, and this court denied cert on that, so that claim is alive in this very case.
Are damages available on that claim?
The claim is a claim under the damages provision of Section 207 for an alleged violation of the Substantive Communications Act provision Section 202. They, of course, also have any remedies any customer has for lousy service here against AT&T, the provider of the service, which received compensation.
Under 202, that there would be, if plaintiff prevails on that claim against Verizon, not AT&T, there would be a damage remedy for the loss that the plaintiff could prove? In other words, does it give the plaintiff the same thing that the plaintiff is seeking here, except it's not treble?
The plaintiff certainly asks for the same damages. Section 207 is the liability damages provision of the Communications Act, and the Second Circuit said that that provision was available to this plaintiff to seek recovery for injury from the alleged violation of Section 202.
Then why did Judge Katzmann say a couple of times the only opportunity for the plaintiff to get damages is if there is this second Section 2 suit?
I'm afraid I can't answer that question, having the court having reinstated that that claim. That is a damages claim. If the court has no further questions, I would reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Very well, Mr. Toronto. General Olson, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, it is not a Sherman Act violation to breach a telephone interconnection agreement. The Telecommunications Act created an extraordinary, carefully crafted, comprehensive regulatory and remedial regime to force lawful monopolies.
Mr. Solicitor General, before you get into your argument, do you have a position on the standing issue?
We did not brief, and we did not take a position in our briefing on the standing question. And our reason for doing that, Justice Stevens, is that we believe that in order to ascertain antitrust standing, one has to connect the injury, the alleged injury, to an antitrust violation. We feel that the question of whether or not there's an antitrust violation in this case comes before the determination of the antitrust injury, and therefore the United States did not brief that question. We do believe that the 96 statute is, as this court characterized it in its previous review of that statute, extraordinary in that it set out to create competition in an area where the antitrust laws would not have accomplished that objective.
Excuse me, I've just been thinking about your prior answer, and we certainly don't do this for standing normally. We normally say the question of whether there's been an injury comes before the question of whether there's been a violation. That's what standing is all about.
Well,
and you say that the government has just concluded that the both questions are of equal priority, and that's just not the way we usually work.
We felt, Justice Scalia, not in the context of Article III standing, but in the context of prudential standing, in the context of antitrust standing, which relates specifically to something this Court has called antitrust injury, which ties into the particular violation. And in order to determine that here, we felt that the Court would have to first answer the question whether there is an antitrust injury itself. Is there any violation of the antitrust laws that would give rise to a Section 2 Sherman Act claim in this
case? But you're asking us to do that in a case where a plaintiff without a real interest may be the one that's demanding that adjudication. This is very odd.
Well, we do think, and had we briefed the question, we would have thought that there was that Trinco had some points here. That this is not an Illinois brick case. That Trinco was depending in part upon service provided by the Verizon Loop, and that it had a choice, as the Trincos alleged in this case, that it had a choice between deficient service from AT&T or paying perhaps a higher price or something else from Verizon, that there are distinctions, and we think that they might. But because we didn't brief that, because we thought it was the Court, first of we have a litigant here that alleges, and we have a Second Circuit decision, and we've got other circuit decisions that have addressed this very antitrust issue, that it's very important to resolve that case, particularly in the context of where we have a significant, extraordinary effort by Congress to create a comprehensive, complex, carefully modulated effort to create something.
And do you take the position that that effort gives Trinco a cause of action under the statute?
That we take, I'm sorry.
Does Trinco have a cause of action under the statute?
In fact, this is an answer, I think, to Justice Ginsburg's question.
Yeah.
The Second Circuit did decide that there was a right to action under the discrimination provisions of Section 202, and this appears, it's the first.
But I thought Mr. Toronto said there is no discrimination in this case. So that if that's true, then there wouldn't be a remedy under 207.
Well, first of all, to the extent that there is, and to the extent that there are allegations of that, the Court addressed that and reinstated that very cause of action. This Court decided not to review that.
Okay,
that appears.
But on the facts pleaded, does the United States take the position that Trinco has pleaded a cause of action under 202 or any other section of the statute?
Yeah, we do not dispute, Justice Souter, the existence of the cause of action recognized by the Second Circuit on page 16A.
Do you dispute that he has pleaded a cause of action?
We do not.
Okay.
With respect to that section of the Communications Act.
Is there any reason he can't go to the VSC like anybody else can and say, I have ducks on the line, I can't hear anything, it's terrible, and then they issue an order, and if they don't follow the order, you go to court and sue them for damage?
That's also true, and there's also an action against the Trinco had a contract with AT&T to supply it with adequate telephone service. It may have a cause of action against AT&T. To the extent that AT&T attributes its inability to provide that service to Verizon, AT&T has already addressed that under the exclusive remedies it had available to it under the contract.
To get to the merits part of the case, the sacrifice test you want us to adopt assumes that certain acts are not pro-competitive. But doesn't the 1996 Communication Act tell us that certain acts are not pro-competitive?
Actually, we submit, Justice Kennedy, that what the Communications Act does is something that the antitrust laws never did do. And the reason that the Communications Act was in fact necessary to break up the monopolies, to cause legitimate, lawful monopolies to do something that the antitrust laws wouldn't require, that is to open up their markets, which they had no obligation under the antitrust laws to do, at a subsidized rate to invite in competition. That entire regulatory scheme was something that Congress decided was necessary to do, which no other laws in existence had been able to do. Therefore, not only, and I think that this is clear from the Court's jurisprudence as well, but also well articulated in the Town of Concord decision that was authored by Justice Breyer on the First Circuit, that regulatory regime which monitors the conduct on an ongoing basis, which the antitrust laws are not well equipped to do, prevents the occurrence of antitrust injury and inhibits the ability to accomplish antitrust benefits and monitors the process in a way that succeeds in dealing with the possibility of anti-competitive conduct, but conduct that was not required at all under the antitrust laws. The opening up the markets, to selling one's assets at a discount, to going into a business that the lawful monopolist was not already in. The additional point there is that the treble damage remedy is considerably more draconian. It acts in an ad hoc, specific case under the supervision of generalist judges and ad hoc juries, whereas Congress decided that the scheme was most appropriate to create this new world that this Court specifically recognized in the two previous Telecommunications Act cases, was this regulatory regime inhabited by experts, administered by experts, where there are prompt, efficient, effective remedies and a scheme which is adjustable from time to time to deal with any anti-competitive conduct. So there's not only reason why Congress said we do not change the antitrust laws by this statute. There's good reasons why Congress decided to do that, but there's also additional reasons why the Section 2 remedy would be a sledgehammer in an area where Congress has enacted a scalpel to deal.
Why do we have to accept or buy into your broader no-help theory of the antitrust laws if we accept what you've just said? Why can't we just say, in this particular instance, we don't have to adopt any general principles of antitrust law, but in this particular instance, the Communications Act has just superseded the Sherman Act.
I agree with that, Justice Scalia, that the Court does not need to go into broader general principles, and this Court, we addressed those principles because we felt we had an obligation, and we have addressed, the government has articulated those same principles not only in this Court.
How can you say the Communications Act has superseded the Sherman Act when the statute itself says it didn't?
It doesn't. No, we're not suggesting. We're not saying that the Act provides any immunity. The Act still exists side by side. What we do say is that this conduct was not a Sherman Act violation before the Act, and the Act specifically says
that's a different point than one Justice Scalia made. You're saying there was no antitrust violation whether or not there was a communication.
That's correct, but it's specifically true in the context of this regime that exists to the extent that there is any anti-competitive activity. This Court has repeatedly said that it must look at the antitrust laws and the application of the antitrust laws in connection with the particular industry and in the particular regime in which it exists. So when this case comes to this Court, it is entirely consistent for this Court to look at the alleged violation of the antitrust laws in that context. The method that Congress selected to create
Thank you, General Olson.
Thank you.
Mr. Verrilli, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'll address the standing question first and explain why consumers in Trinco's position have standing and why General Olson is correct that Illinois Brick is not a problem. Then I'll show why it would be unwise and unwarranted to adopt the discrimination test that my friends on the other side advocate as a matter of Section 2 law, and why the 1996 Act is crucially relevant, and why the antitrust laws in that Act should be enforced in tandem as Congress indicated.
And at some point in your standing discussion, could you address whether Trinco could judicially sue AT&T? You're giving us lousy service and lousy money back.
I think Trinco could have brought a suit like that. Of course, AT&T would have then said it was Verizon's fault, which it was, and there would be.
It's not usually a defense to failure. The contracting party to deliver added services out of the contract.
Well, that's correct, but in this situation, there might well be filing rate doctrine problems with a suit like that. There would be all kinds of problems.
like that. In any event,
There are many, many members of the class who have different kinds of injuries from the other members of the class. It's a little hard for me to understand precisely how the wrongdoing that affected AT&T necessarily carries over to customers of AT&T.
The means by which Verizon was trying to monopolize the market, as the complaint alleges, and I think this is clear from paragraphs 1 and 2 and 54 of the amended complaint, was that Verizon was using its control of the local loop that competitors needed to lease to get service going to degrade the service that its competitors, including AT&T, were able to provide to customers. That was the means by which the antitrust scheme was effectuated, and as a result—
Are you alleging that they not merely failed to perform their duties, but they actually interfered with AT&T's performance of its
retail
obligation?
Correct. I think, you know, remember—
Because that's a little different from the way the Court of Appeals described the complaint.
Well, I understand it, Your Honor, but the complaint, one of the difficulties of this case, of course, is that we're here on a complaint, and the test under Rule 8 is a notice pleading test, and the complaint can only be dismissed if there's no conceivable set of facts that could be proved consistent with the allegations in the complaint that would support relief. And
yes, but you have to have alleged in your complaint just how it was that Verizon's misconduct hurt your clients.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think paragraph 2 of the amended complaint says that Bell Atlantic deterred and will continue to deter potential customers from switching to another company for local phone service or cause customers that switch back to Bell Atlantic in frustration for the poor services rendered by their local phone service provider. There are other places in the complaint where it's specifically alleged that the quality of service that AT&T customers get and other competitors' customers get is degraded in comparison.
Look, under the what bothers me about the Illinois brick problem is I completely agree with your characterization, but the law would seem odd that would say when Smith, a price-fixing ring, charges Jones $3 extra, we don't let Jones's customers sue for the actual overcharge he undoubtedly suffered. But in fact, when Smith, the monopolist, drives Jones through predatory pricing out of the market, we let Jones's customers come in and say, oh, my service isn't as good. I may have, I don't know exactly, I might have switched, I got bad service, etc. You see how much more ephemeral that is? How much more uncertain it is, how much more vague it is. And the more precise thing we don't let them recover for, the more vague thing on your theory, which is highly speculative, we will, on your view, let them recover for.
Well, I think it's the right answer to let them recover, and it's not speculative. This conduct directly raises the cost and degrades the service that consumers in the market receive. And they are entitled under Rider against Sonatone to sue for the damages that those occur. And, it, you know, Illinois Brick, I'm not here to defend the wisdom of Illinois Brick in the context in which it exists, Justice Breyer, but it has been narrowly confined to that context. And if you don't have an overcharge case, you don't have Hanover Shoe. If you don't have Hanover Shoe, you don't have Illinois Brick. So
the other thing that I had as a question on the merits of the complaint is if this complaint had said that Verizon went to the customers who were trying to use AT&T and said, Mr. Customer, we're going to wreck your service unless you buy from us, or indeed carried that out in through surreptitious ways, but that's what he was saying. You buy from us or you'll be sorry. If that's what the complaint said, you might well have a complaint. But I don't see that in the complaint.
Well,
rather, what I see in the complaint, and I want you to point out where it's the contrary, is that every claim of bad service is connected through a because or some other word like that to the refusal of Verizon to hook up AT&T, i.e., to provide them with the Verizon service so they can provide service to the customer. Now, I've read the complaint a few times, but I want you to point out to me the part that you think most clearly contradicts what I just said.
First, paragraph 2, which is at page —
2 is the overview.
Yes, but what it says, Justice Breyer, is that they degraded service. Well, the degraded service has to occur not only during the process of switching over, but after the switching over. And, of course, under Swierkiewicz and under Leatherman, the test here is whether there's any set of facts that could be proved consistent with these notice pleading allegations that would support a cause of action. And I think your Honor's question proves that there is, the first set of facts that you're
describing. I'm not with you completely for the reason that the overview seems to be an overview which is explicated by the specific complaints of exclusionary conduct which appear later in the complaint.
But I think those complaints are fairly construed to include denial.
I would like you to point out.
I think it's true about paragraph 52. I think it's true about paragraph 54. I think that is the essence of the complaint here. And, of course, that makes sense because these are exactly the kinds of allegations. This is the way monopolization occurs. This is the way maintaining monopoly power occurs in this arena. There is a long and unfortunate history that goes back to MCI against AT&T and continues.
All right. Then with paragraph 54, which I thought was the heart of the complaint, what it seems to say at the end is when they did these bad things, the plain effect was that AT&T was prevented from offering local phone service of the quality as was offered by Bell, and thereby to impede the ability of AT&T to compete. And so I took 54 as being essentially a complaint that AT&T is kept out of the market.
Well, what it says, yeah. I don't think.
And if you don't, in other words, have an obligation
to bring them into the market.
Well, I think
under the antitrust laws, you lose.
I think you do have an obligation on the antitrust laws, and I'll try to get to that as fast as I can.
If you don't, do you lose?
No, because this says to
where are you reading from, Mr. Brown?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chief Justice. It's at page 46 of the Joint Appendix, paragraph 54 of the amended complaint. What it alleges is that AT&T and other competitors weren't able to provide service at the level of quality that Verizon could. It doesn't only say that they weren't able to provide service at all. It says both of those things. And so I think the allegation is there in 54, and I think and it's described in the overview of in paragraphs 1 and 2 of the amended complaint explains how it works. And I'd like to, if I could go to the core antitrust issue here. I think it is common ground, my friends on the other side, that a monopolist's right to refuse to deal with competitors is not an unqualified right. They acknowledge one qualification. That's where the monopolist discriminates. They argue that's the only time a Section 2 duty ought to be imposed, because that in that situation you can be confident that it's anti-competitive conduct, and you won't have problems with dampening incentives, and you won't have administrability problems because you can refer back to the prior course of dealing. But where they're wrong is in suggesting that that's the only time that you can find liability under Section 2 for monopolist refusal to cooperate with its rivals. It is equally true in this case, in this situation, where, as Justice Kennedy's your question earlier indicated, there is a regulatory regime in place that requires competitive access on the part of the monopolist in order to bring competition into the market. And what you have, and I think these allegations are consistent, what I'm about to say is consistent with the allegations in the complaint, and what you have is a course of conduct on the part of the monopolist that is intended to subvert the competitive entry that those regulations require.
Well, you say then that the 1996 Act gives you affirmative momentum that you wouldn't have if it were just the antitrust laws?
I wouldn't put it quite that way, Your Honor, but I will answer your Honor's question directly. The test under the Sherman Act for exclusionary conduct applies in the same way that it's the exact same test whether the 96 Act is there or not. The test is whether the conduct impairs rivals' opportunities to compete in the market and whether the conduct does or does not further by the monopolist further competition on the merits. That test would apply to a different factual scenario after the 1996 Act was passed than before. And it's clear that that must be the case. For example, Your Honor, one thing that the 1996 Act did, and this is Section 253 of the Act, which I think is at page 90 of the appendix to the petition, it eliminated, preempted state monopoly franchises. Now, prior to passage of the 1996 Act, If Drinko went to bring a Section 2 claim against a local telephone provider in a state where there was a monopoly franchise law, Drinko would be out of court on the state action doctrine. There would be an ironclad defense. Well, Section 253 of the Act preempted the defense. So obviously, in that situation, there is an antitrust claim that wasn't there before, and so it can't be the case that the passage of the 1996 Act has no relevance whatsoever to the application of Section 2 of the Sherman Act. And indeed, we think it would violate the Savings Clause and impermissibly modify the applicability of the antitrust laws to conclude that the 1996 Act is the sole remedy here for a person in Trinko's position.
Well, you're modifying it either way, aren't you? I mean, you're modifying it if you say sole remedy. You're modifying it if it gives, in the Chief Justice's words, momentum.
I don't think so.
Modification either way.
I don't think so, Justice Souter, because the statute says that nothing shall supersede the applicability of the antitrust laws.
And the momentum theory, in effect, says the applicability is being modified because there's a declaration of certain anti-competitive conduct.
Well, I don't think so. I think the exact same test applies before the Act was enacted and after, so it doesn't modify the substantive antitrust rule one iota. What it changes is the facts to which the rule applies. Now, in this case, it would not be true.
But I thought you were invoking the Act for the characterization of those facts as anti-competitive.
Well, yes, in the following sense, Justice Souter, but I don't think it constitutes a modification of the applicability of the antitrust laws. It might change the result under the antitrust laws, but not modify the applicability, because the general rule under the antitrust laws is that one takes the regulatory context into account. And the fact that conduct violates extrinsic norms, and in particular when it violates, as it did in MCI versus AT&T and in the Litton Systems case in the court, cases in the Court of Appeals, when it violates extrinsic norms that are designed to promote competition, that counts against
Are you saying that the Telecommunications Act imposes new duties, and the violation of those duties now becomes an antitrust violation?
No.
You want to talk about the facts of the market. I understand that.
I think the
thrust of Justice Souter's question as well was that the Telecommunications Act imposes new duties, and violation of those new duties is really the gravamen of your complaint.
I don't think that's quite right, Justice Kennedy, and let me try to explain why. The test is whether the monopolist conduct prevents competition, obstructs competition, whether it does so on a basis other than competition on the merits, and whether there's otherwise a legitimate business justification. And that's the general rule, as the United States acknowledges at page 14 of its complaint. That's the rule that was applied in Aspen, the rule that was applied in Kodak. That's the rule. That rule applies here. When one answers the first part of that test, which is, does the monopolist conduct obstruct competition, it's not the case that any violation of the 1996 Act would obstruct competition. What has to be shown there is that the monopolist conduct is sufficiently grave, sufficiently serious, sufficiently sustained, that it amounts to an overall pattern that obstructs competition. So it's not the case that there's an automatic transference of a duty under the 1996 Act into an antitrust duty. But where the 1996 Act becomes relevant is when you get to the next stage of the inquiry. And I think it's just what Your Honor said earlier. At that stage in the inquiry, the monopolist does not have open to it the argument that this is pro-competitive behavior and that I have a legitimate business justification for it, because in that circumstance, it is unlawful to do it. And so it can't be a legitimate business justification to say, I don't want to do something that the law compels me to do because I'll be better off as a competitive matter if I don't do it. So it does enter the analysis. It's not irrelevant by any means, but it doesn't transform or change in any way the antitrust standard. But it does have this additional effect.
Or does it say we define pro-competitive in a new way based on the Telecommunications Act? The Telecommunications Act is pro-competitive.
Well, I think it does say that this is conduct that I think you can no longer say that it is consistent with competition on the merits for a monopolist to refuse to cooperate when a law designed to promote competition insists on the cooperation. So I think in that way, I agree with Your Honor, that's what's happening here. And then the other thing that's critical is
what is cooperation? I mean, the main obstacle in my mind to your argument is that if we accept your argument, it will be a violation of the antitrust law not to agree to interconnect with the new competitor coming in. Immediately, it will be a question of, was that refusal reasonable or not? What were the terms? What were the pricing? What was the lease arrangement, et cetera? Because there's no way to know whether it's justified or not justified under the law without going into those details. You and I both know that there have been opinions written in this court that just skim the surface of the complexity of answering that kind of question. And the main obstacle to your argument, in my mind, is it seems to be a question of whether that incredibly complex question will be answered by a regulatory agency in a regulatory proceeding brought by complainants or by 500 judges and juries in antitrust cases throughout the country, each potentially reaching a different answer.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. And the reason why is this, because I think that question, if I may say so, I think it picks up on what I believe to be a false choice that my friends on the other side are presenting. And that's a choice between, on the one hand, a duty to deal relegated solely to the circumstance of discrimination, and on the other hand, a wholly unqualified duty to deal that might raise a lot of the problems that Your Honor has identified. But there's a middle ground here, and it's the middle ground that I submit to Your Honor that Professor Arita identified in the 1989 article, and that makes a world of sense. And that is, when there is a regulatory regime in place that supplies the background norms, then the juries don't answer those questions. The juries decide something very different. What the juries will decide in that set of circumstances is whether the regulatory requirements have been violated or not. And they'll also, and remember, many of these regulatory requirements are contractual terms.
And many of those regulatory requirements consist of something called TELRIC blank slate, which happened to cover an unbelievable number of pages, and I'm sure would come into the argument about whether the pricing condition is or is not a reasonable one.
I don't think that's right, John. I think it's an obvious defense in a case like this for an incumbent to say, well, I'm in compliance with the law, and I'm in compliance with my contractual obligations. I think it's also a defense for an incumbent, as it was in the MCI.
Does that go to the jury then? So you say it's a defense, but it's always going to be argued, no, you're not in compliance. Yes, I am in compliance.
Yes. I think the answer is, if it can't be resolved on summary judgment, of course, Matsushita says that summary judgment has a particularly important role to play in antitrust cases, but if it can't, then it will go to the jury. But that's really not any different.
Then you have the jury determining whether TELRIC pricing has been properly applied or not, don't you?
No, I don't think you do, because the way this is going to – what we're talking about here, Your Honor, is something very different. There might be a contractual provision, for example, that says you've got to cut over the loops from your own switching system to our switching system within an average of 6 days. Now, if a plaintiff were able to come into court and show, well, you know, the contract says 6 days, but actually it's taken them 6 months, and as a result we're being disabled, that's not anything different than what an antitrust court and what an antitrust jury is asked to decide in any case. These antitrust cases are complex. There's no getting around that. But they go to a jury if there's a dispute of fact. There's no getting around that either. And this is no different from any other one.
Only when the claim relates not to the refusal to interconnect, but to the failure to provide adequate service after interconnection pursuant to a contract.
Well, I'm sorry. You know, I think there would be claims of both kinds possible, certainly.
Well, let's suppose it's a refusal to interconnect.
But the
refusal to enter into a contract.
That's also governed by the same set of regulatory norms, and it takes away.
In that case, at least, you'd have to put to the jury the question of whether the refusal to enter into this contract was an unreasonable one, which would depend on these very subtle pricing determinations.
I think there might be some circumstances, Your Honor, in which it would be a harder case to make. And that might be a case where a judge could appropriately say, it's too complicated, it can't go to the jury, or might appropriately say, this is a matter for primary jurisdiction. But it is not a black and white situation in which the right answer here is to cut off an antitrust remedy that Congress clearly envisioned when it enacted that savings clause. Congress enacted the savings clause to make clear that antitrust was to operate in conjunction with the regulatory regimes here. And with all due respect.
Yes, but this is in some ways a sort of derivative cause of action that Trinco brings, with the primary injured party probably being AT&T. And so it is a concern when you address it in this context, isn't it?
I think that it is a concern, but it is not a concern that defeats standing for the reasons I gave earlier, and it is a concern that can be overcome through the normal processes of discovery under the federal rules. And with respect to the substantive antitrust claim that's before the court, and in fact, the existence of the regulatory regime solves the problems. It sets the benchmarks. It functions as a benchmark in just the same way that a prior course of dealing would function as a benchmark in a discrimination case.
Mr. Varelli, in attempting to determine whether these two pieces of legislation operate on separate tracks, Telecommunications Act, Section 2, Judge Wood said, one of the problems with reading the Telecommunications Act effectively into Section 2 is that then Section 2 of the Sherman Act might eclipse this elaborate regime that Congress set up, because why would any player want to use that mechanism instead of coming into court with the possibility of getting treble damages?
Well, I think the answer is, Your Honor, because in the absence of an effort by an entity, a competitor, to use the mechanisms that the Act put in place, then that in that situation, the entity doesn't have an antitrust claim where they could show exclusionary conduct based on subversion of the regulatory requirements and lack of a legitimate business justification based on refusal to abide by the regulatory requirements, because they haven't invoked the regulatory requirements.
But after, because certainly AT&T could go back to the regulator and say,
yes, Justice Ginsburg, that's right, but I think that's a far different situation from the one that Judge Wood described. And I think it's important, critically important here, to understand where the regulators are on that very question. The regulators don't think there's interference if there's mutual enforcement. It's notable that the Federal Communications Commission is not on the brief for the United States and the Federal Trade Commission today, and that's because their position, which is articulated in orders which we cited the footnote at page 38 of our brief, is that the duties that they impose, the access duties and specific obligations, ought to be enforced under the antitrust laws as well as under the Telecommunications Act, and you know, the lessons of history are behind that, and the lessons of common sense are behind that. The fact is that the regulatory regime that the FCC tried to put in place to bring long-distance competition and to bring telephone equipment competition was insufficient, standing on its own with all of those regulatory mechanisms, to make that competition occur. That competition occurred only when vigorous antitrust enforcement was brought to bear, in part to enforce those very regulatory requirements. And that makes a great deal of common sense, of course, because the incumbents in this situation have every incentive in the world for this system not to work, because they want to retain as many customers as they can, and they want to make as much money as they can, and they have ample ability to do it. There's 1,000 ways in which they could subvert this regulatory regime by using low-intensity obstructionist conduct that history has shown is beyond the power of the regulators to capture and prevent. And that is why antitrust law needs to apply here. It's why the FCC says it should apply. It's why the 15 states who've submitted a brief in support of our position on this says it should apply, because that's the only way, operating in tandem, that we're going to get to the competition that Congress tried to bring about. And I submit to this Court that is exactly why the Savings Clause is in the 1996 Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. excuse me, Mr. Verrilli. Mr. Toronto, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. The words competition, obstruction of competition, pro-competitive, mask a fundamental distinction between the 1996 Act and the Sherman Act. The 96 Act creates competition. Section 2 of the Sherman Act has always gone no further than protecting independently developed competition. The 96 Act is a comprehensive regime for policing the 1,000 ways, as Mr. Verrilli said, in which the obligations to create competition might be violated. This complaint, if you look at the two paragraphs that Mr. Verrilli cited, paragraph 2 and paragraph 54, is all about helping to create competition. Paragraph 2 says the conduct we complain of is that Verizon was making it difficult to obtain full use of Verizon's local loops. There is no allegation of obstruction of AT&T's independent efforts to create seller-buyer transactions on its own without help. What we ask the Court to say on the merits here is not that there is a rigid requirement of discrimination or anything else. What we ask the Court to recognize is that up till now, helping hand cases have been limited by the requirement of discrimination between customers, not between self and others, but between customers. And there are compellingly strong reasons not to expand Section 2 beyond that. For institutional reasons, the antitrust courts are not capable of reliably making the necessary determinations. And for fundamental incentive reasons, the incentives of incumbents to invest, the incentives of rivals to invest rather than piggyback. In this context, a common law-like context, there's no question of overriding pre-existing settled antitrust obligations. The question is, should the court create something new? And in a common law-like area, the existence of another regime is one strong reason not to create something new. The court said so in the Black and Decker case only last term involving the common law of ERISA obligations when the court said the scope of permissible judicial innovation is narrower where other federal actors are engaged. That's what we asked the court to decide, that the 1996 Act is one compellingly good reason not to create new Section 2 law here. Thank you. If the court has no further
questions. Thank you, Mr. Toronto. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.